The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Christian Outlook, the weekly radio program that sorts through the issues in our fast-changing world in a way that honors your Christian faith. Sponsored by the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Georgine Rice. This week, violence grips our big cities.
This is happening in every city in America that's run by a Democrat.
Some in Washington, D.C. seek to make the District of Columbia our 51st state.
It's a very popular position with the Democratic base right now, presumably because if D.C. were to become a state, it would most likely elect Democratic members to the Senate and the House of Representatives.
Cancel culture infects big business.
The people who are driving the agenda are not large groups of people.
And now they've come for the most popular Broadway show in America.
You can't live in a time where people are wanting to pull down George Washington statues and expect that Hamilton can go on as a love letter that it is to America.
We've got all this and more. I'm Georgine Rice, your host, and it's great to be with you. Coming to you from Portland and my home station of KPDQ. You can hear my own program live each weekday afternoon at 93.9 FM here in Portland and online via our website at kpdq.com. Also through the TuneIn radio app. Thanks for joining us. For a while, the murder rate in America was down. Fewer people were on the streets as a pandemic kept us sheltering in place in our homes. But as states began to open up, crime rates began to go up. And then we had the in-custody death of George Floyd by a rogue police officer, and everything changed. Protests nationwide shattered the pandemic rules of social distancing, but few leaders complained in consideration of the issues at hand. Emboldened, protests turned into riots and looting, and violence returned with a vengeance. At that same time, activists who despise the police gained an unprecedented leverage with progressive city councils. Together and with new authority, they indiscriminately attacked law enforcement. Soon after, the left began to undermine and dismantle police departments that, in some cases, dealt with some of the more difficult neighborhoods across the country. And once again, the murder rates skyrocketed in New York, Chicago, and Atlanta, to name just a few. Bernard Carrick is a former New York police commissioner who oversaw the department during a very different era. He spoke with Kevin McCullough on AM 570, The Mission, in New York City.
How bad did it get this weekend for the Big Apple?
Well, in New York City alone, we had 44 shot, 6 dead. But you know what, Kev, this is, and there's something you should focus on when we're finished here. There were two tweets that went out, one from the borough commander of Manhattan South and the borough commander of Manhattan North, which is Harlem, Spanish Harlem, Washington Heights.
Right.
Both of these commanders, two star chiefs in the NYPD, both calling out the politicians, the Manhattan South borough commander, calling out the district attorney, Vance, where are you? You know what? That's pretty sickening. That is pretty sickening, because that sends a serious message to the citizens of New York that there's dismal stuff going on in the streets. When you don't have the politicians out there, when the DA is not working with the police department to lock up the thugs, basically, you know, they're following the traits of the rest of the country, where we're villainizing the police, victimizing the thugs. And it shows when you look at cities like Chicago over the weekend, 76 people shot, 14 dead. In Atlanta,
wow,
28 people shot, 4 dead. In Cleveland, 20 people shot, 3 dead. This is happening in every city in America that's run by a Democrat, that's supporters of Joe Biden. This radical leftist Marxist ideology that basically coddles criminals, that basically victimizes criminals and thugs. And who do they target? Who do they go after? Like in Atlanta, they go after the police. You had 6 cops 4 weeks ago that were arrested and fired. 5 of them were black. Five of them was in the fugitive squad and the Atlanta PD. These are the men and women that go out and hunt down the really bad guys. They fired them for making a lawful arrest and using a taser. It was completely outrageous. It was a political arrest, a selective arrest, should have never happened. But at the end of the day, that's what we see with these left-wing mayors and governors who basically are cowering to the Joe Biden ideology of let's coddle the criminal.
Well, I haven't even really been able to fully comprehend what Joe Biden's concept of law enforcement is, but I know a lot of people around him are saying things that are somewhat unbelievable. You know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez says that cutting $1 billion from the NYPD budget isn't even a good enough start for her. And when we consider, Bernie, that 600 anti-crime fighters are off the streets, is it any wonder that New York is starting to resemble Chicago in a way that it had not for decades leading up to this period of time?
Yeah, Kev, you're talking close to 30 years. I mean, that the change began in New York City in 1994 when Giuliani came into office and murder rates, I think we were averaging about 2,200 murders a year. When I left office, we had dropped that number down to 670, about a 70% reduction in murder, the most substantial reduction in the history of the country at that time. And since then, we dropped it to under 300. Now, under de Blasio, this will be the first time in close to 30 years, we've had increases in violent crime, shootings, and murder. The first time. And it happened under his watch.
And then when I think of other cities like Baltimore, who have for the last 5 years, and they're a much smaller city than New York, but for the last 5 years, they've averaged more than 300 murders per year. They've already eclipsed that for this year, this calendar year. And it appears as though there's no stopping it. And yet, Bernie, city after city of the cities that we're talking about, Atlanta barely escaped defunding by one vote. One vote on their city council would have gone to cut $73 million of $120 million budget. Now, just think about how to police a city as the size of Atlanta on basically a third of what you had had the year before. But Baltimore is going to cut $22 million. We're going to cut close to a billion here, $19 million coming out of L.A. There's city after city. You could just go through the statistics. It's simultaneous to the crime explosion. These cities are voting to take funds away. Bernie, what's that going to do to our country?
Well, it's going to destroy it. It's going to destroy those cities. And anybody that was around in the 80s and 90s, early 90s in New York City, you would know that the only way we were able to reduce crime and reduce murder and reduce shootings was adding police to the streets in the high crime areas. Basically, we took heat maps. Those maps identified where all the violent crime and murder was. And we programmed and processed cops into those areas where that violent crime and murder happened. That's how we were able to reduce the crime. When you eliminate that or you diminish that in any way, you're going to see spikes in crime. $1 billion out of the NYPD budget is close to probably 16-18%. You know what? This is going to be devastating. Devastating for New York crime-wise, but also economic development-wise, real estate value, tourism. Nobody wants to live, work, visit, or go to school in a place where they're not safe. And you're going to see a substantial decrease in all of the things that had flourished over the last 30 years.
Not far from New York, the nation's capital is also experiencing a great deal of turmoil. Like many other troubled parts of the country, Washington, D.C. is led by Democrats, many of whom would like to add to their power by making the district a state. I covered the subject with Zach Smith of the Heritage Foundation, who explained why the party is so anxious to make Washington, D.C. our 51st state. You know, I think for many people who don't think very deeply on the subject or haven't given it much thought of late, might assume that, you know, D.C., the Washington, D.C., the District of Columbia, why not allow that to become the 51st state of the United States? Can you give us a little bit of background here so that we understand, first of all, the seriousness of this and whether or not the House has the authority to make said declaration?
Sure, absolutely. And whenever we talk about whether or not D.C. can become a state, there are really two perspectives to it. There's the legal perspective, and then there's also the pragmatic perspective. And if we start with the legal perspective, in the Constitution, it specifically spells out and says that there shall be a federal district that shall not exceed 10 square miles, and it shall be the seat of the federal government. And that's essentially what Washington, D.C. is today. But as you know, as you and all of your listeners know, Washington, D.C. does not currently have any voting members in the United States Congress. It has a non-voting delegate. And so the push that's been made has been to allow D.C. to become a state, receive two senators in the Senate, and at least one voting member of the House of Representatives. Well, the problem with that is that the Constitution explicitly says that there shall be a seat of federal government that's not part of any state. And so the legislation that passed in the House of Representatives on June 26, it would essentially shrink the seat of the federal government to be the area of the National Mall, the White House, the Capitol Building, the Jefferson Memorial, the Lincoln Memorial, those areas, and no more. And if we go back and shift to the pragmatic side of the argument, you know, if we look back to the history and why the founders decided to create a seat of government not within a state, that idea just seems problematic and absurd, really.
Now, what you're describing then is something like a Vatican within the United States, just this very small area that's designated as something other than the area surrounding it, which would become the District of Columbia or something like, or Douglas Commonwealth, I think is the name they came up with. Now, why now? Right. And when we know that the U.S. Senate is not going to support this, we know that President Trump has committed to opposing it, too. Why now? And what would be the purpose for Democrats who almost overwhelmingly, save one vote, supported this notion of establishing the Douglas Commonwealth?
Well, it certainly seems to be a politically advantageous position for Democratic lawmakers to take to gain support with their base. It's a very popular position with the Democratic base right now, presumably because if D.C. were to become a state, it would most likely elect Democratic members to the Senate and the House of Representatives. So that certainly cuts in their favor. And kind of the other impetus behind this recent push has been, you know, we saw op-eds in the New York Times from Susan Rice, Barack Obama's national security advisor, and in the Washington Post from D.C.'s mayor, Muriel Bowser, saying basically, you know, they were upset because with the recent protests and the unrest and the looting and rioting, they did not have the authority. D.C. local officials did not have the authority to stop President Trump from sending in the National Guard or even federalizing the District of Columbia Police Department if he needed to. And they said, you know, that's an infringement on their sovereignty. But if you go back and look at the history behind why the District of Columbia was created, it really shows that the founding fathers wanted a separate federal entity that's not dependent on local authorities for its safety and security. And they wanted the federal government to be able to control basically what happens within that federal enclave. And so the District of Columbia, as currently structured, provides that. If it shrinks down and kind of establishes that Vatican-type state, like you mentioned, clearly it would be very difficult, if not impossible, mm-hmm. for the federal government to effectively control what happens in that area.
Coming up, the left goes after their own.
You can't live in a time where people are wanting to pull down George Washington statues and expect that Hamilton can go on as a love letter that it is to America.
The Christian Outlook returns in a moment. This COVID-19 crisis is straining the limits of our constitutional system. Over the next few years, we'll see a generation of new and grounded policy leaders emerge. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Georgine Rice. For decades now, big business has been vulnerable to the demands of the left. Supported by the mainstream media, progressives have become more aggressive and unquestioned. No business wants to cross them if they can avoid it. The cost is simply too high. Determined not to let any crisis go to waste, many on the left have increased their demands to conform, and sadly, businesses that want to survive allow themselves to be manipulated as never before. But is there anything believers can do to stop it? According to economist and writer Jerry Bauer, there is. He joined the ride home with John and Kathy on Word FM in Pittsburgh.
When COVID-19 started to hit and, of course, George Floyd protests started to take place, I think all of us, we started to get messages from corporate America in our inbox making statements about where we are in America. To me, this was a weird thing, but it feels as though it's becoming increasingly normal to all of a sudden have corporate America act as though corporate activists.
Yes. So in that case, the corporations would be the activists, like corporations are acting as social activists. Now, why are they doing that? Well, partly they're doing it because they're being poked by political activists. And so they're afraid. They don't want to be tagged as evil in some way. In this case, the accusation would be that they're racist, or they don't want to be tagged as bad for the environment or intolerant of gay people or whatever the issue is that's being pushed. So it's really interesting. I mean, these companies are gigantic. They're huge, right? We're talking about trillion-dollar companies in many cases. And it's almost like a bull that's led around by a little nose ring that's pulled by a child, in the sense that the people who are driving the agenda are not large groups of people. There are not a lot of people who are, say, into the philosophy of Black Lives Matter, the organization. There are a lot of people who believe Black Lives Matter. Absolutely. I would hope everyone does. I would think the majority of people do. But BLM has a certain ideological agenda. So there are not a lot of people who believe that we need to shut down all use of fossil fuels because it would send us back to the Stone Age. But we have companies saying we're going to stop using fossil fuels. There aren't a lot of people who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, or queer. Not a lot of trans people. And yet we have companies basically being kind of pulled around to, say, open up their bathrooms to someone of the other gender. And so how is it that such small groups of people are able to sort of jerk around these giant companies? And I would suggest it's because they show up and the rest of us don't. And that's the thing that I'm trying to reverse, which is to get in particular Christians, people who are grounded in the Bible, to begin to take seriously the fact that we've got 401ks or 403bs or IRAs, whatever your deal is. You've got your retirement account, and in there are stocks, and those are shares of stocks, and that makes you the owner, and that makes you the boss. So start bossing a little bit. Start actually using the authority that you already have, rather than essentially completely ceding that ground and letting pretty extreme voices essentially dominate the corporate discussion.
Yeah. Fabulous. Okay, so then we do have voices, right? If we have money invested in the market, there's an opportunity for us to speak up as well, especially to espouse and speak about our Christian worldview. Now, Jerry, in a piece that you wrote, you're talking about the Trump administration from the other side of the aisle going after corporations as well, right?
Yeah, and they're doing a couple of things. One, they're saying if you're a social media company, you're an internet company, you were under a set of rules. And those set of rules were, hey, you're just a soapbox. So if somebody stands up on a soapbox and says something really stupid, someone stands up on a soapbox and says, smoking is just terrific for your lungs, and it turns out that's not true and you know it wasn't true, you can sue them, right? But you can't sue the soapbox. You know, the soapbox was just stood upon, right? If somebody calls you and gives you bad advice, you can sue them, perhaps, but you can't sue the phone company. They're just a carrier. They're neutral. So early on, internet companies, internet service providers were treated as neutral. They're just the air. They're just the ether through which the message flows. They're not part of the message. It's not like a newspaper where you pick and choose articles. Newspapers are responsible for what they publish. But Facebook and Twitter were considered not really responsible for what they publish. The problem is they start coming in and they put their thumb on the scale. They pick and choose based on whether they like the message or not. They might say it's about safety or whatever, or fact check, but they fact check in a biased way, which means they have an editorial point of view, which means that they really aren't just a soapbox. They're making choices. They have an editorial stance. They're now communicators. They're now publishers, in which case, why should they be under this special protection from lawsuits that other publishers who take a point of view are not? The Justice Department is arguing they can be sued for content because they're no longer a neutral carrier, but they are, in fact, a publisher.
Not surprisingly, cancel culture targets conservatives, especially Bible-believing conservatives, with their demands for conformity. And in recent years, they've gone after entertainment as well. Comedy has been stifled as much as it is, by its nature, politically incorrect. But then they came for the beloved Broadway musical, Hamilton. Salem's Kevin McCullough discussed the surprising move with Carol Markowitz, columnist for the New York Post.
We're speaking with Carol Markowitz, whose current piece this week is very timely because last week Disney Plus debuted the streaming version of Hamilton. And of course, this is the production of the big hit. Carol, I'm dying to know Number one, did you watch it? Number two, how many times have you watched it so far?
I haven't seen it yet. But as you know, I'm a giant Hamilton fan. I saw it 4 times on Broadway, and I know that that's insane. I love the show, but then I love America. I love our founding story. I love, you know, the story of our founding fathers. I could watch George Washington portrayed on a stage forever.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting because Hamilton's a show for me. It's a show for the person who loves America, right?
You know who else it was for? Barack and Michelle Obama and Mike Pence. And yes, everything in between.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And so this fringe that wants us to hate America and hate George Washington and hate Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, it's a crazy mixed up world when we're really hating on these amazing men who did amazing things and were deeply flawed and did horrible things too, but were human and are portrayed in the Hamilton show as the humans that they
are. And what's interesting about this, Carol, is so my bride says to me sometime over the weekend, you know, it's not going to be long before they're going to come for Hamilton. And I said, yeah, but think about how woke Hamilton was. Like, there's hardly any white people in it. I actually am not a huge fan of Hamilton, the historical figure. I love the show.
Right.
I think that I disagreed with him on some ideas about how government should operate. But the fact that you get this understanding of what it costs to kind of have America is really, I think, the value of this. And Lin-Manuel Miranda and all these actors and actresses, they were seen as cutting edge. And you had you had an African-American woman win the Tony for, you know, her performance. And I'm like, OK, so this surely isn't going to be canceled, is it? You tend to think that it still might be.
But so my column came out on Friday. It normally runs on Monday, but I wanted it to be released the same day as the show. It came out on Friday, and by Monday, there were already calls from the left to cancel Hamilton and attacking Lin-Manuel Miranda for whitewashing history, etc. It was so obvious this is where we're going. You can't live in a time where people are wanting to pull down George Washington statues and expect that Hamilton can go on as a love letter that it is to America. I hope Lin-Manuel will stay strong. I don't think he will, though. I think he will fold. I think he will apologize. I think that members of the cast will apologize. But I hope they stay strong.
Well, I hope that they do as well, because I think it's a gift for our society. By the way, downloads of Disney Plus increased 74% in only one weekend due to the Hamilton debut. So if anybody is going to say, hey, where's this market on this? Disney can point to that and say, well, who are all these people downloading our app then if they didn't want it? Anyway,
Carol, Kevin, the secret is people love America. That's where we are.
Yeah, just don't let anybody know it.
It's a fringe that doesn't.
Coming up,
be safe, wear a mask, social distance. We just accepted these things like somehow this is absolute scientific medical proof.
The Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Hey, welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Georgine Rice. If you are one of those people who like facts, the COVID-19 pandemic scare is likely driving you crazy. So what are the facts? They seem to change daily. Okay, wear a mask, don't wear a mask. It's getting better, it's getting worse. It's nothing to worry about. It's the worst thing since the bubonic plague. But as believers, we're told not to be fearful. KKLA host Frank Sontag begins there.
I want to speak against fear. I had posted an article that said COVID-19 is close to losing its epidemic status in the U.S. according to the CDC. It's from a website, justthenews.com. And then I started getting DMs. Well, do you have a reputable site? This isn't Reuters or so. Who are these people? Again, instantly we go to, that can't be the case. Statistically, and I believe the numbers can be manipulated. I mean, we have a worldwide website called worldometers.info. I track every day. The daily death total from, I would say, mid-April, when it was quite high, now we're back way down again. That's just information for you to consider. But here's what I want to share with you. If you don't know who Dr. C.L. Gray is, I'm inviting you to discover who he is. Another bit of information that I posted on my Facebook page is a website, flattenthefear.com. Be safe, wear a mask, social distance. Do you have any idea where social distancing came from? You may want to look into it. About 15 years ago, something very interesting occurred. From, you would be shocked if you heard who was responsible for the first idea of social distancing. But now, again, everybody, be safe, wear a mask, social distance. We just accepted these things like somehow this is absolute scientific medical proof. So who's Dr. C.L. Gray? He's the founder of Physicians for Reform. Here's a little bit about what he shared. Quote, "We must isolate the few to protect the many, instead of the many to protect the few." End quote. You get that? Now there's talk of another maybe possible lockdown where we quarantine healthy people. Let me read you a little more of what Dr. C.L. Gray says. Quote, "At my own hospital, our ER typically treats 180 patients a day. There were times at the peak of the coronavirus that our ER was almost empty. We had to furlough a lot of staff, and we all took salary cuts," end quote. His hospital tripled their ICU beds, expecting a surge based on what was happening in New York, but they never needed the excess capacity. Gray said, quote, "There were times we were down to 30 to 40 patients in the hospital because so many people were scared to come in. They were afraid they would get the coronavirus there," end quote. "Sadly, many suffered heart attacks and strokes, but never sought treatment. Another woman with leukemia died without care." Gray talked about others. Quote, "There were many patients who could have received treatment. They didn't, simply because they were afraid." But he believes the fear-mongering associated with a recent surge in cases is overblown. He examined statistics in Texas and Florida, two states where the media has predicted imminent doom. Gray shared, quote, "People can lie with statistics. I did research looking at trends over the last month, May the 20th through June the 20th. In Texas, new cases are up 180%. But daily deaths are flat." I'm going to put a little caveat on this. I heard an interview earlier today with a prominent doctor in the Houston area where the media is spinning, this is now ground zero for the second wave. And they specifically named this hospital. Do you want to know what the doctor said? He said, "I don't know what hospital they're looking at or what Houston they're talking about. It's not my city. It's not my hospital. There's an agenda being pushed here." Let me finish what Dr. Gray said. Quote, "To prevent further harm, people with serious, complex, and acute illnesses must now return to the doctor for care. The novel coronavirus will not go away soon, but its systemic side effects of fear and deferred care must."
Coming up, why are so many young girls struggling with their sexuality?
We also have the thorough gender ideology indoctrination in the schools, so it's constantly being suggested to them.
The Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Stay with us. This COVID-19 crisis is straining the limits of our constitutional system. Over the next few years, we'll see a generation of new and grounded policy leaders emerge. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to The Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Georgine Rice. Gender dysphoria is a serious issue that's been with us for some time, a condition that ought to be treated with utmost compassion. What we're seeing with our youth today, however, is something altogether different. Tragically, it's falling under the same label. Why? When Wall Street Journal writer Abigail Schreier, she wrote her book about this issue, Amazon refused to run ads for it. The title of the book is Irreversible Damage, The Transgender Craze Seducing Our Daughters. And it helps explain the problem our youth face today. Only one side is permitted to speak. Abigail Schreier sat in on the Eric Metaxas Show.
We have a 100-year history, diagnostic history of gender dysphoria now. We know what it looks like. And what these teenage girls claim to have is not gender dysphoria. It doesn't match up with what we know about gender dysphoria. So it really is a contemporary hysteria through the schools of girls self-diagnosing with this. And unfortunately, we've put all these categories of people under the same in the same bag and surrounded them with civil rights and the idea that this is a brave new thing. But in actuality, I think it's several different phenomena going on at once. And with the young girls specifically, what they're suffering with does not seem to be gender dysphoria per se.
See, this is why it's so difficult, right? You've just said it. I mean, people try to make sense of this, and you're talking about several things at once. And I think that, you know, what I've seen here in Manhattan, in New York, where I live, that it becomes a thing, right? In certain circles, it's the thing that so-and-so in my class has decided, you know, that she's a boy, so-and-so, that it's suddenly, it's in the drinking water, as it were. And that's what you talk about in your book, that suddenly now you have all these young women, I guess, responding to various social pressures. And you're saying that's genuinely different than somebody who really is sincerely struggling and trying to figure this out. This is more of a trendy thing that has kind of captured the minds of young people.
Well, I do think these girls are genuinely suffering. So I definitely would say these girls are in severe distress. But very often, as with, you know, hysterias of the past, you know, multiple personality dysphoria, even anorexia and bulimia, girls have been able to spread this, which doesn't mean they're not in distress. They're in serious distress. They have very high rates of anxiety and depression. They're in pain. But when they look to describe that pain, sometimes they look to things that are in the culture, and they've latched onto this. Even, and the reason we know, by the way, this isn't traditional gender dysphoria is these girls have no childhood history. Gender dysphoria has always begun in early childhood, and it overwhelmingly afflicted males. So in the 100-year history of gender dysphoria, we've never seen it start in adolescence and be overwhelmingly female. And yet now they are the dominant demographic all over the West. Girls, between 2016 and 2017, the number of gender surgeries for natal females quadrupled in the United States. So we know that this population that has never, this demographic that has never before experienced gender dysphoria and has experienced something that really doesn't look like exactly like gender dysphoria is experiencing it in the highest numbers. And it's the same demographic that falls prey to a lot of social contagions.
I was going to say that's right. In other words, it seems to me that, you know, when you hear about girls cutting themselves or you hear about a number of things along those lines. So there's real pain, but it finds a channel in this trend. Everybody's doing this or doing this, and now it's this, but the title of your book is Irreversible Damage. This, it's not something like bulimia or anorexia, which is reversible. It's a different kind of problem. How did it happen that this became a way that young women are dealing with, you know, the kind of pain that seems to come along with much of adolescence?
So there are a couple of reasons this happened. First, these young girls are in severe distress. So this generation of girls, we know they have extraordinarily high rates of anxiety and depression like we've never seen before. And several researchers now have tied it very precisely to the introduction in 2007 of the iPhone and with social media. We know that social media causes us to compare ourselves to other people, and that causes everyone, you know, some measure of anxiety and feeling bad. And we know that adolescent girls suffer the most from this. So we know we've got this distressed population. At the same time, we also have the thorough gender ideology indoctrination in the schools. So it's constantly being suggested to them that they might not be their gender. Okay. This is constantly presented as an option to them. We also see it that the transgender status has been raised in the culture, which, you know, some may say is a good thing, that they're no longer treated as poorly by the society as they once were. But there's been a rise in status of transgender people. At the same time, you've seen a diminution in status of girls and women. And you see that when you have, you know, biological boys out competing them on sports teams, taking their trophies. You know, you see that in mediocre biological boys, I should say, mediocre athletes taking their trophies, men pushing their way into their locker rooms. It's no secret that the culture has really turned its back on girls. And so you add all that together to the fact that, you know, adolescence has always been a hard time for girls. Your body is changing, your hormones are raging, and it's by its very nature a very vulnerable and difficult time. And now you're constantly telling them they could choose something else. And the last thing I should add, by the way, this is a time when victim status is something very sought after by our youth. And this is the only victim status that a young white girl can choose. And so many of them do.
It seems to me, you know, that this is a failure of moral courage. In other words, that there are plenty of people who know something's wrong, but they know that there's a cost to speaking up. They know that they will be on the outs if they come against some of the ideology that's being pushed. And, you know, when I hear you talk about this being pushed in schools, I think it's a very fair question to say, is it any business of government schools to be pushing this kind of ideology? Why are they doing this? I mean, this is no different to me than if they were teaching a particular religious faith in the schools. It's not their role to do that, but they really have pushed their way in.
They have. And actually, my chapter on the schools is one of my favorite chapters because I was able to sort of go deep and really, I hope, unearth what was actually going on in California, and which is a model for public schools across the country. I can only say that there was no difference between when I looked at the people and the materials they were using. It turned out there was no difference between the teachers and the activists.
To hear the rest of that important conversation between Schreier and Metaxas, go to ChristianOutlook.com. Coming up, can Californians sing in church?
Bottom line, worship is legal, singing is legal, and people should do so without fear of the government this coming Sunday.
Details when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Georgine Rice. Telling believers they can't lift their voices in worship is dangerous business. But with the pandemic numbers increasing over the past week, that's the message many got from the governor of California. But that message isn't quite accurate. Brad Dacus of the Pacific Justice Institute explained how it works on Lifeline with Craig Roberts on KFAX in San Francisco.
Give us a bit of a background in terms of the genesis of this most recent sort of rub when it comes to churches gathering and what they can and can't do.
Certainly. Well, many churches, as you know, Craig, all churches basically were shut down completely initially in California and across the country for the most part. And then they started doing the reopening. And then they started saying, well, restaurants, you can reopen. Churches, you can't really open yet. Other events, activities, you can do it, but churches can't protest. Yeah, we're going to allow that. That's no problem. First Amendment rights. But churches, no, you can't. You're not protected by the First Amendment to come together and worship. So it's been very problematic. We've seen some victories. We had a victory in Calaveras County in a major federal case we filed, and we're seeing some success. Then, Craig, the governor came out with this no singing pronouncement, saying you cannot sing, and the media took this, and they reported that singing is banned in churches. Well, we did our homework at Pacific Justice Institute, and our chief counsel took this on personally, and we investigated it. What we found out is that it's not that bad, and it's not that binding, because it only applies to, it's an OSHA guideline, Occupational Health and Safety Administration guideline, for the state of California, which means it only applies to paid employees. So as far as members, people attending church, volunteers in a church, they can sing and worship to their heart's content. Obviously, it's good to have, you know, proper spacing, social distancing. They may or may not want to wear a mask, but they're free to sing. And then as far as those who are paid, like the worship leader or the pastor, you know, they're up there singing. They're paid employees, so technically they're not supposed to sing. But even then, I think it's, you know, going to be difficult to go after them and prove that they were singing and not lip-singing. It's okay to lip sing, you just can't sing. So, and then when they're so far distant, so far away from the congregation, which a pastor usually is, worship leader usually is, and even the worship team are usually spaced way out, I don't see that as really a bona fide risk. So bottom line, worship is legal, singing is legal, and people should do so without fear of the government this coming Sunday. So singing is fine, both in terms of legally as well as in terms of biologically, so long as you have that safe distancing.
That wraps up this edition of the Christian Outlook. Remember to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Google Play, and never miss these and other great conversations. Thanks for joining us today. Our program has been brought to you in part through our partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF Alliance Defending Freedom. For executive producer Russell Shubin and producers Charlie Richards, David Posehn, Mike Cook, and James Blend, I'm Georgine Rice. Join us again next time for the Christian Outlook. So she ran away in her sleep.